Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
And Ken, all of political dumb is stunned.
What'd you call
and
me?
Reeling.
Did you call me political dumb?
All of the world of politics, the greater realm of people who care and observe elections, is absolutely stunned because of the shocking result
in Vermont.
From Alaska. From
the
Alaska,
whole, the
Ken.
Whole week.
And of course I'm talking about the stunning breakthrough victory of Scotty McAdams from Sitka on the Democratic primary side.
There's a lot of places to start from Tuesday's primaries, but the Alaska Republican Senate nomination, which was supposed to be a Lisa Murkowski slam dunk, we do not know who's going to win that.
We do not know. Something along the lines of 1,650 votes, roughly. We're dividing the two candidates after all the primary precincts had been counted.
91,000 total votes cast.
This is not a huge number of votes because, after all, we are talking about a sparsely populated state and we're only talking about the Republican votes for the moment because we've already saluted Scotty McAdams' history-making breakthrough on the Democratic side. But we do not have a winner, even though there's a 1,600 and some odd vote margin. Why not?
Well, the reason we don't have a winner is because there are still 16,000 absentee ballots and provisional ballots that have not been counted yet. They had to be postmarked by primary day last Tuesday. They have 10 days to reach the counting, and the counting begins next Tuesday, August 31st. So we won't know for at least that time next week, if not longer, who's going to be the next Republican nominee for the Senate. But Lisa Murkowski, this was something that Murkowski was never thought to be in doubt. Joe Miller, the Tea Party favorite, and somebody endorsed by Sarah Palin.
And Michael Huckabee.
So anyway, the big victory for the Tea Party. And, you know, we kept saying maybe their influence is waning. And, of course, if it's waning, you get an umbrella.
I don't actually know if anyone anywhere was saying, is the Tea Party influence waning?
So, I think that
maybe so. But the fact is, the Tea Party is still, in a very real sense, in its emergent phase. Whatever else it is, we don't know exactly what the Tea Party is. It's a loose amalgam of people with similar feelings. But whatever else you have to say about it, it's still a rising movement. Now, we're recording this podcast a couple days before a rally that's going to be held by some elements of the Tea Party, those that are particularly interested in the preachments of Glenn Beck on Fox News. They're coming to Washington to hold a rally and to mark the anniversary of Martin Luther King's famous speech on the Mall and the steps of the Lincoln Memorial back in 1963.
And who better to commemorate that but Glenn Beck?
Well, that's the controversy, and a lot of people are upset about that. A lot of people who feel that they're closer to the true legacy of Martin Luther King are denouncing Glenn Beck even for talking about Martin Luther King or scheduling his event on the same date. He, of course, says it's a coincidence. The Tea Party is very much part of the political discussion of the summer of 2010, as it was in the summer of 2009, although it's taking a different form. A year ago, it was town halls and protests of the health care bill. Now, it's all about the elections in November.
Back to Lisa Murkowski, though. The fact is, she, in retrospect, of course, she seemed like she handled the whole campaign strategy all wrong. Unlike John McCain, who recognized a threat from the right, he switched his positions on immigration, spent a ton of money, and went negative on J.D. Hayworth from the beginning, Lisa Murkowski thought that the name of the game was the way Ted Stevens used to do things. Here's what I've done for Alaska. Here's the money we've gotten from Washington. Here's the largesse and the pork and all that thing. And voters will reward me for another term.
Well, there really was no other Lisa Murkowski she could show them because that was so much the kind of senator that she has been and tried to be since she was appointed by her father 8 years ago. There was another difference, though, and another problem for her in trying to run the McCain playbook that he ran so well this week in Arizona, beating J.D. Hayworth handily. It wasn't any kind of a contest in the end at all, but
we thought it would be four or five months ago.
And the polls were showing it would be 4 or 5 months ago, and then the polls went south on J.D. Hayworth. He only had about a seventh as much money that he could spend. His ads weren't nearly as effective.
He had Jack Abramoff.
And he had problems of his own.
Right.
This is what Lisa Murkowski did not have handed to her on a silver platter like John McCain did. J.D. Hayworth was a controversial figure who lost his own congressional seat in a basically Republican district back in 2006. And then he went out and he made some ads where he tried to encourage...
An infomercial, right?
Yeah, an infomercial where he told people, you too can get money from the federal government. Here's how you do it. It's all free. Very ugly stuff.
McCain jumped on it from the beginning. Right, exactly.
And he said a lot of intemperate things over the years. Let's face it, he was out there. He was always a controversial figure.
You're absolutely right. Joe Miller did not give Lisa Murkowski that opportunity. Joe Miller basically was a blank slate. He was the antithesis of Lisa Murkowski, the small government no government, and certainly he wasn't the rhino the way the Tea Party was describing Lisa Murkowski.
And better really than a blank slate, because the shorthand things that he could put in a quick ad were all very positive. West Point graduate, Gulf War veteran. He had been a lawyer. He'd been a federal judge briefly. And this is a guy who had a positive story to tell in very short form and no ugly record to have to hide or run away from, as so many of the other candidates who have tried to emerge as independents or as new figures in politics have had this year.
But a lot of people thought that, especially in the wake of the recent passing of Ted Stevens, there might be a Stevens nostalgia going through Alaska, certainly in the Republican Party. Ted Stevens was the longest-serving Republican senator in history, and it took a corruption conviction to defeat him, and only barely by Mark Begich in 2008.
And here again, you know, we were counting absentee ballots in that race as well. So I thought, actually, the Ted Stevens factor would... She cloaked herself in it. She did what she could to take advantage of it. I thought that was going to help her.
He actually did some ads for Murkowski shortly before his death, and of course, after the plane crash, she decided not to use. But, I mean, that's how close Stevens and Murkowski were.
I'm actually surprised she didn't use them, and I think that's a decision that might very well be second-guessed.
Win or lose, I think it's fair to say it's a great victory for the Tea Party. I'm not sure what it means about Sarah Palin. Libby Casey, reporter for the Alaska Public Radio, was on Talk of the Nation this week, and she said the way she sees it is that Sarah Palin gives a little endorsement, be it via Twitter or Facebook, and then the Tea Party sees where Sarah Palin's sympathies lie, and then they come in with a money buy. You don't need a lot of money to win a race in Alaska, but I think it excited a lot of conservatives. And there was also that parental consent measure on the ballot that brought out conservatives.
That brought out specifically anti-abortion activists, and they were motivated again by Sarah Palin in particular here. Lisa Murkowski supported the measure. She was not opposing the measure, but she, of course, does not have anything like the anti-abortion credentials. She's basically seen as pro-choice by anti-abortion activists, and so both Joe Miller and Sarah Palin vastly preferable to those people, and those people came out in good numbers. The measure only passed 55-45, but I suspect that the 55% that voted for it were very heavily concentrated both on the Republican side and on the Joe Miller side of the Republicans.
And I guess the other question is, those who voted early, the 16,000 absentee ballots, were they not affected by this proposition that was on the ballot? Did they vote early enough? And that could be some good news for Murkowski. Wednesday, the day after the primary, Murkowski says, "You ain't heard the last of me yet." Mm-hmm. So she is showing some kind of confidence, but boy, I'll tell you.
She needs a 60-40 split on those ballots, and she's under 50% on the rest of the ballots. It's a little hard to see her getting 60-40 on the absentees. Is there a chance she runs as an independent? She still has that option, I believe.
That rumor has been out there. I suspect that she doesn't do that at all. I mean,
she doesn't pull a Charlie Crist.
I think the odds are against Lisa Murkowski making that third-party independent bid, but Florida is a good example because in both races now, in the Senate race and the gubernatorial race, it's a three-way contest. In the Senate race in Florida, of course, Kendrick Meek defeated Jeff Green for the Senate nomination.
Handily, hugely, right. 25 points
and
more.
And Jeff Green had spent gazillion dollars on that race.
$30 million. It was more Jeff Green's collapse, though, yeah. I think, than Kendrick Meek suddenly gaining stature. I mean, he got an endorsement from Clinton and one from Obama, but everybody was not shocked by those endorsements. I think he just benefited from Jeff Green being exposed as a highly flawed vessel.
I agree, and I think, as we said last week, I think that the Democratic primary in Florida for the Senate was a battle to see who was going to finish in third place. Perhaps more African-Americans will stay with Kendrick Meek now, and maybe that hurts Charlie Crist. That gives Marco Rubio a boost, but I think the Democratic candidate for Senate in Florida finishes third. Now, in the gubernatorial race, that's fascinating too. Another good example of the establishment versus the outsider being Tea Party-supported candidate Rick Scott, who was a multimillionaire, a businessman, who, to his detriment, was a CEO.
Columbia HCA.
Right, a hospital chain in Florida that was sued a $1.7 billion fine for Medicare fraud.
That's the biggest fine ever paid by anyone for Medicare fraud.
And this is who the Republican Party has turned to. Rather than having a career politician named Bill McCollum, they went to somebody with a suspect ethics like Rick Scott.
But very strong ads and tons of them, and $40 million in some of his own money,
right.
Maybe 50, and the ability perhaps to do it again. And I would have to say, a highly compelling persona on television. He came across so much stronger on television than Bill McCollum.
If that's possible.
That is, you would have to have a lot of information to make the choice of Bill McCollum over Rick Scott. Nonetheless, a lot of the polls, Quinnipiac poll, the Mason-Dixon poll, clearly showed McCollum ahead. 4 or 5 points outside the margin of error. in the last days before the election. So that was a stunner, too. Not quite on the Alaska level of stunning, but it was nonetheless a stunner.
But that shows there are big problems for the Republican Party in Florida. One, you have Jim Greer, the former state chairman, who's under indictment. You have the departure of their governor, Charlie Crist. Of course, many Republicans say good riddance. But there is disunity in the GOP in Florida, and that could help Alex Sink, the CFO for the state, who would be the first, I guess, Democratic governor since Lawton Chiles, if she's elected. However,
except there's another Chiles in the race.
That's right.
Running as an independent, as you said a moment ago, Bud Chiles.
Lawton Chiles III, Bud Chiles, is running as an independent and could complicate Alex Sink's candidacy. But again, why are we talking so much about Florida governorship? I mean, obviously in the Senate, there's a vote and it affects everybody. But every 10 years, as you know, redistricting plays a key role in politics. Florida will gain a seat in Congress in 2012, at least one in 2012, which means two more electoral votes. And given the fact that Florida has a Republican state legislature, whoever is elected governor, either Sink or Rick Scott or Herbert Chiles, will be crucial to deciding how the seats are drawn in redistricting.
But let's go back west, though, for a second, Ken, because you mentioned earlier the contrast between Lisa Murkowski holding off a Tea Party challenger and John McCain holding off a Tea Party challenger, and McCain having so much more success in doing it. Is there anything else to glean from this other than that John McCain was successful in scrambling back to the bosom of his party's conservatives and reassuring them that he was one of them and not a maverick after all?
Well, those who admired, I mean, there are a lot of people who admired John McCain as the maverick in 2000, and of course he's moved.
Even in 2008.
Well, yeah, perhaps, you know, I mean, he's certainly took more conservative positions in 2008, but not on immigration. I think John McCain.
He backed off immigration in 2007 and 8, even off of his own bill, refused to say in a debate in 2007 that he would have signed his own bill if he were president.
If your original proposal came to a vote in the Senate floor, would you vote for it?
It won't. It won't. That's why we went through the debate. No, I would not, because we know what the situation is today. The people want the border secured first.
But I mean, basically, here he out Hayworth in the Senate race, and I think that certainly helped him. We could talk all we want about John McCain's legacy and did he sell his soul to get renominated. But look, the name of the game is winning, and he clearly won. He won big. Also, another example of a winning big in Arizona is Jan Brewer, the governor. When she became governor, when Janet Napolitano left to join the Obama cabinet, everybody thought there would be like 12 different Republicans running
against
Brewer.
And there were about a half a dozen running
for a long
time. Strong
Republicans, but once she signed 1070, the anti-immigration bill, all the other Republicans backed out and said, there's no way we can beat her.
I think only a couple even stayed in the race. I mean, a couple, three stayed in the race. Nobody, a lot of them dropped right out.
Nobody significant. And now she is a clear favorite against Terry Goddard, the Democratic State Attorney General.
Well, she won on Tuesday this week with, I believe, 87% of the vote. And, you know, the number of people voting in that primary, despite the lack of competition, because she was clearly going to win, was overwhelmingly larger than the Democratic showing for Terry Goddard.
Now, she won big, but the Republican nominee in the third congressional district, the one that John Shattuck is giving up, didn't win that big, but he won nonetheless.
Less than one vote in four, less than 25% of the vote. There were two other candidates close behind him, but there were 10 candidates overall. And so Ben Quayle will be the nominee of the Republican Party in that quite Republican district, although perhaps not an impossible district for the Democrats, depending on where we go in the future now with Ben Quayle.
And in case people forgot, Ben Quayle is the son of Marilyn Quayle.
Yes, and that's good to note. And he is also known in some quarters, I believe, as Brock Landers.
Yes, that was the alleged character he used from Boogie Nights when he wrote for DirtyScottsdale.com.
But this was several years ago,
right?
To be
No, wait a second. That was way back in 2007.
Okay, it was several years ago.
That was a lifetime ago.
He is also an attorney.
Right. He also says that Barack Obama is the worst president in history.
That's right. And he took off after the president, right after having won his nomination. Although I heard one story that he had actually canceled his victory party because he didn't think he was going to win.
Well, right early in the evening, it was very, very close. I mean, look, there were a lot of candidates bunched close behind. And Quayle was nervous about it, but ultimately he did survive. And I suspect he is the next congressman from Arizona's 3rd District.
And so, moving from the sun-baked tennis courts of Scottsdale, Arizona, let's traverse entirely the United Lower 48 states all the way to the far northeast of the country and the little state of Vermont.
The Democratic Republic of Vermont.
Where lately a traditionally Republican state, a New England rock-ribbed Republican state, has become one of the bluest of the blue and went so overwhelmingly for Barack Obama in 2008 that it may even still approve of Barack Obama today. What happened in their governor's race?
Well, before we do that, I mean, talking about the Republican roots of Vermont, first of all, I believe it was the first or second best state for Dwight Eisenhower in 1956. And when Pat Leahy was elected to the Senate for the first time in 1974, he was the first Democrat ever elected to the Senate, and now he's running for a seventh term. It shows you how the Democrats have come in Vermont.
Am I wrong, or was Vermont one of two states to vote for Alf Landon in 1936?
Right, the old expression, as Maine goes, so goes Vermont. Those are the two states that Landon got against FDR. And FDR, of course, was named after that highway in New York, which was significant.
That was significant and helped him in New York.
But now,
I'm sure,
the big primary news in Vermont was the race for governor. Jim Douglas, the Republican, decided to retire.
He was succeeded in the Republicans' minds by his lieutenant governor,
Brian Doobie.
Brian Doobie.
And, of course, Frank Sinatra sung that in Strangers in the Night. And so the race for governor, Peter Shumlin, the Democratic State Senate President pro tem.
Peter Shumlin emerged. Well, a lot of people were watching Deb Markowitz.
The Secretary of State. She finished third, but she finished 782 votes back. The guy who finished second place was State Senator Doug Racine.
Wait a minute. Wasn't that the character from Body Heat?
That's Ned Racine.
I'm sorry.
Doug Racine, who finished, apparently, he finished like 182 votes behind Shumlin. Everybody who says, every time people say that, does my vote matter or not?
It does in Vermont.
It clearly did in Vermont.
If you can stand the winners, you can vote and matter.
Two states before we get to the big September 14th primaries, and of course we have time to talk about that in subsequent podcasts, but this Saturday, two primaries of note, actually not much of note because we know who the nominees are.
Not a lot of suspense in Louisiana.
The Senate race for David Vitter, the first Republican elected since Reconstruction, and for a long time was questioned whether he would survive another term because
he had that problem with Madam, D.C. Madam.
That's right.
Right, and also some stories about his extracurricular life in Louisiana itself.
But David Vitter is the Republican senator, and the Democratic nominee will be Charlie Melançon.
He will be the Democratic nominee, and under more normal circumstances, that would probably be a highly competitive race. Vitter has had his problems, and Melançon is very popular, not only in his district, but in other parts. You're shaking your head because it's 2010.
It's 2010, and Louisiana is one of those states, like Arkansas, like other states, where the Republican strength is growing even in the wake of unpopularity with President Bush and the Republican record in Congress.
In 2008, Louisiana was actually adding Republicans even in 2008.
So I think Vitter gets reelected. And also there's a special Senate primary in West Virginia on Saturday as well. Of course, we know who the nominees will be. Joe Manchin will be the Democratic nominee. He's the current governor to replace the late Robert Byrd, and the Republican nominee will be John Racey, who has run for the Senate twice before, lost to Jay Rockefeller and to Byrd. Looks like there'll be a Democratic retention in November.
And while we're mentioning Louisiana, let's remember this weekend is the 5th anniversary of landfall for Hurricane Katrina. President Obama will be down in New Orleans to mark that anniversary on Sunday and to look for signs of progress in the painfully slow but continuing recovery.
If we're talking about sad anniversaries, it's also been a year since Senator Edward Kennedy died in Massachusetts. And what's so remarkable about that, if you look at the year in politics, in the years since he passed away, Scott Brown is the most popular politician in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Who'd have thunk it?
That's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.